Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for joining us at the Daily Friend. My name is Mario Surratt. I'm standing in for Nicholas Lorimer, who is getting married this weekend. Congratulations to Nick and to his future wife. Hope she knows what she's getting herself into. And I'm joined by Michael Morris from Cape Town. How's it, Michael?
Very well, thank you, Maurice. Nice to be joining you, and nice to see you too. I'm new; I haven't been on the show with you before, so this is a first. Great
Yeah, I'm obviously
to join you.
joined by Anlu. I'm sorry, Anlu, I'm not sure how to say your surname. Is it Kiefer? Kiev? Yeah, give us a clue.
It's
How do you say
Kiefer,
it?
but I've
Kiefer.
had
Okay, so
quite a few
joined by
versions.
yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, and then obviously joined by Anlu. Kiefer is also from joining us from the Cape. So I'm the only Gautenga today, I think. So yeah. Before we'll get straight into it. So first thing we're going to talk about is there was quite a interesting opinion piece published by Anthony Butler. I think he's a professor at the University of Cape Town. So it's entitled "The Ramaphosa Seems to Be Enjoying the GNU Ride." So he says it starts with the president. Cyril Ramaphosa gives the impression that he's enjoying presidential office for the first time. On the face of it, this is surprising. After all, the ANC has suffered a decline of electoral fortunes under his leadership. And then goes on to say there are perhaps three reasons for Ramaphosa's seeming contentment. Firstly, that he's done pretty well with the GNU. He's managed to find some consensus amongst people outside of the ANC. And he's had a lot of his enemies have either gone to the EFF or to the MK party. Michael, I'll start with you. Do you agree with Professor Butler, or do you think he's maybe missing the marker?
No, I'm inclined to agree with him, but I mean, I've always regarded him as a very measured and insightful commentator. He doesn't tend to go off for tangents, and his analysis, I think, is always very sane and measured, as I say. Just while we were chatting before the show about Cyril Ramaphosa and his background, one of the things that I remembered so well. And it was this huge story, you can imagine at the time, was in the early 1990s at CODESA talks, when Cyril emerged as the key negotiator for the ANC. ANC was still something of a sort of unreadable presence. Nobody was entirely sure what ex where exactly it stood, what sort of beast it was. And here was Cyril, and Cyril emerged as the sort of bearded, quite jolly, quite smiley, a kind of huggable figure who happened to be their chief negotiator, and the person that his opposite number, the person in the National Party, who emerged as an equally almost a kind of unlikely figure as the kind of key negotiator and the guy who was going to get a hold of the line for the existing elite, was of course Ralph Mayor, and. No sooner had these two begun working together than they became really quite intimate. They became, I think, they credit to both of them. They discovered a lot about each other that they understood and liked and could trust, and so they built that trust for the process for the future of South Africa, really based on their personal chemistry. And there was this one particular thing that I'll never forget, was the story about the two of them, quite an unlikely thing, really, when you think about it, going fly fishing what's a place called Dullstroom, I think. I think it was up there in that neck of the woods. And on some occasion, in the course of their kind of morning's fly fishing, breaking the ice and just sort of getting to know one another, Rolf got the hook caught in his hand, and he kind of submitted to Cyril to cut the wound a little bit and extract the hook. And this emerged as this amazingly powerful symbol of, what two South Africans from very, very kind of extreme ends of the politics up to that point. Could actually achieve when they came together. They could actually help one another in this really quite simple but quite very personal way. So yeah, I mean, I was immediately reminded of that. I think it's quite interesting that Cyril does seem to be much more at home with this kind of politics. We recall that when the election results in May were formally announced, Cyril Ramaphosa appeared to be really quite relaxed about it, and was quite jokey and smiley and so on. It was almost as if he was relieved that that this had been the outcome, and that now his true calling could be made visible. He could play this role. But the most important things, in a way, about Anthony Butler's piece come right at the very end, where he talks about the two of the more critical policy positions that have emerged since May. The one being the Bailable, the Basic Education Laws Amendment Bill, with those two very controversial clauses, and the other being national health insurance, also very controversial and affecting a lot of South Africans. And he concludes by saying it's not impossible at all that the GNU will bring a pragmatic compromise, or pragmatic compromises will emerge from the GNU that improve overall outcomes in both cases, and that if the coalition survives, in many others besides. And I think that is true. Obviously we've got to watch this very closely. It's not a done deal yet, but NHI and Bella, we've got 3 months on Bella, and we're not quite sure what the time scale is of negotiations on NHI, but those two things are going to be, I think, quite a telling indicator of whether this good mood Ramaphosa is going to actually deliver goods.
Anu, there's also one line here where Anthony Butler says, another reason for the president's newly placid demeanor may be a fresh chance to shape policy, somewhat freed from vested interests in the ANC's tripartite alliance. I think that's something important to look at. I think Ramaphosa, he is a bit of a reformer. There have been some reforms in his first term. There's also been some very bad policy. We nearly had EWC. Obviously, things like NHI have come through. And do you think, the power of the SACP is not as strong as it was within the ANC or COSATU, and some of the more nefarious elements in the ANC have been removed, and a lot of them have gone to the EFF and MCAS, or so. So do you think Butler's right there? Do you think Ramaphosa is going to be able to push more reforms, or do you think it's a bit of a false dawn when it comes to that? I mean, as Michael says, we still have Bella and NHR, but, we have had the more contentious clause of Bella taken out. It remains to be seen if they're going to still remain out, or if they will become law at some point.
I tend to agree, Marius, but if I can I just quickly mention before I address that, I agree with Michael as well. He seems a lot more at ease. And it's, as you said, Michael, he seems to be making a little bit more jokes in public. At some stage, you could really see in his eyes, especially, that he's tired and he's a little bit somber, a little bit down, probably from stress. But yeah, he seems a lot more at ease now. And I think much of this is for the fact that he's always been a natural negotiator. It shows in the way that he handled things also post-election. If I think of a natural negotiator, you can see his clear communication. You can see some of the emotional control on his face is usually, it keeps one tone. He doesn't have much facial expression. And especially as you mentioned now, Marius, he has quite creative problem solving, taking out those two clauses, whether it causes more problems or makes fewer. I won't speak to that at the moment, but he definitely, it was a creative move from his side. And I think it definitely, he's in a position that he can now comfortably manage. It's a ship that he definitely knows how to steer, a ship made out of negotiation. So I think he's in a good position at the moment. And there's also, to an extent, the wins from the DA ministers and some of the other ministers in the coalition party, in the GNU, even though I know there's some politics about whose wins it actually is, it is to some extent still their wins. They can play the card of, but we're willing to work with them, even though we obviously know about the election outcomes. But so I think he's in a good position. I think he from his body language, at least, it seems like he's in a happy position, in a position he's happy with.
I think if you just look at how he was, especially during COVID, I think it was either the first or the second time he did a national address about COVID. You could just see how tired he looked, and he looked absolutely terrible. He had like these red-rimmed eyes, looked like he'd been crying. And even during the election campaign, he was, I think it was actually quite a low-energy election campaign now for Ramaphosa and the ANC. You know, it seemed to be going through the motions. And as soon as the election results came out, it was like he was an energizer bunny. Suddenly he seemed a bit more energized. He seemed to have a bit more, you know, boomer, to put it that way. But there's just, before we move on, there's just one line I want to read out from Andy Butler's piece here. It says, another factor behind Ramaphosa's good cheer may be the simplification of ANC internal management the election has brought. MK and the EFF have attracted politicians with legal difficulties and spokespeople with complex psychological challenges. Each of them would otherwise be making Ramaphosa's life difficult inside the ANC. It is arguably better to have Muzwanele Mani or Carl Nias inside the tent pissing out rather than outside pissing in. But it's surely better still to have them on a different campsite altogether. I just thought that was quite a good line that I quite enjoyed. So then moving on to our next story. So it looks like Gauteng could be facing something of a day zero. Apparently the provincial government is reluctant to call it a crisis or to say that Gauteng is going to have a day zero like Cape Town had a couple of years ago. But it seems that Gauteng is going to face severe water shortages, and that's because of a number of reasons. It's because infrastructure is an issue. There's water leaks. People aren't getting built properly and so on. There's also been delays with the building of the Lesotho Highlands Water Project. Apparently, if that had been done properly, it would have been finished in 2019, and Gauteng's current water problems wouldn't be as severe as they are if they even would have existed. Now it's only going to be in 2028 that the Lesotho Highlands Water Project will be completed. And there's also other problems with such as the census. The census has probably undercounted people significantly. So Gauteng probably has a lot more people than the census says it does. So this adds up to, it's all quite a frightening situation. I suppose you two Cape Townians aren't too bothered about seeing as you're quite far away from Gauteng and you've already gone through your issue. But Anu, what do you make of this? Do you think this is do you think we can compare Gauteng and Cape Town when it comes to this kind of thing? Is it down to management? I mean, Gauteng is also in quite a dry part of the country, and apparently it's also the only province where you've got to pump water uphill. Most of the other provinces, you can use gravity to help you pump water. Gauteng's not really like that. So, so what do you think of that? I mean, what's the solution? Should Gautengers just suck it up and not flush when you go to the toilet now? Or, you know, I don't know, drink beer instead of water? I'm not sure.
Well, I think a start, at least, is for the municipalities in Gauteng to start actually communicating with the citizens. It doesn't help you implement any plans for water usage. If you want them to lower their water usage, you have to actually communicate it to them. And it seems like there's quite a few citizens that don't actually know what's happening. They implemented what is level one over the weekend or last week. And apparently some people didn't even know it's happening. And if they knew, they didn't even know when or at what times or... Yeah, so that's, I think, the first thing. A big contributor to the problem is obviously, so I think it's the infrastructure leakage index. It was something like 4.4 in 2013, and it's now, which would then be well-managed physical losses in terms of water. And it's now at something like, I think, 7, or it was at 7 last year, which indicates very poorly managed physical losses. And I know in some provinces it exceeds 50%. So there's obviously a big role to play in terms of maintaining and actually managing much of these losses. Pipes leaking, so it points to the fact that they have been neglecting the most important thing, which is actually investing and maintaining these infrastructures. And I think we're eating, this is going to be a bit ironic, but we're eating the fruits of corruption. And it's ironic in the sense that fruit can't actually grow without water. So, I think there's a big problem. And the first step I'd come back to it is at least communicating effectively, improving what they tell citizens to do when. If you work as a team, it's usually the outcome is much better.
I see I was muted. Sorry, there's a bit of a boomer mistake there. Anyway, yeah, even when up here in Gauteng, you knew all about day zero and the problems and so on. Yeah, as you say, there's been very poor communication. But even, I mean, if you drive around around where I live, just kind of the eastern parts of Johannesburg and the East Rand, often you see, a water pipe that's burst and a road's full of water, and it'll be like that often for a couple of days before it gets sorted out. And maybe nobody's reporting it, but you assume people are, but it just takes a while for people to come fix it. And then that comes down to all kinds of things, mismanagement, or there's just not money to send out a team, or there's just not anybody available, which comes down to, that filters down from the top, though, this kind of thing. So, Michael, you lived through day zero. What is your advice for Gautengers? Is your advice just move down to Cape Town, or what do you think?
Well, I think certainly, your suggested advice is the best one. Go for beer rather than water. I think start with that. That'd be a good place to start. I agree with Andrew. You know, communication is absolutely vital. I think during the crisis in 2016, although there was lots of criticism leveled at the city, and most of it, I think, quite unfair. It's always, very difficult to predict weather patterns. We've had very dry patches before, but this was obviously the worst. But also the population has grown, the city has grown, so the demand for water is greater. So it all around it was very difficult. But the key thing was that every day there was communication put out by the city as to what the plans were. We had a clear sense that they were measuring very, very closely, several times a day, actually, how much water was left, what we needed to reduce household consumption by. So every household actually knew really what to do to contribute to the effort of avoiding the day zero. And so the communication was very good. That helps to also to build trust, obviously, in the solution seeking on the part of city administrations. And I see in this piece that we talk about, I think it's a Business Day Business Live piece. There's a specific reference to the fact that the water problem in Gauteng goes back to the bungling and political meddling in a crucial mega project that would have eased the water supply challenge facing the province. There's nothing you can do about that. But certainly, A, being honest about it, and then B, having a clear plan and telling consumers, telling people at the other end of the taps and the lavatories and the showers and so on what to do, what they can do to make their own lives better. We certainly got into a habit, and it's more or less continued, of saving shower water, of flushing the lavatory much less than you normally would, just using whatever secondhand water you had to hand. And in that way, I mean, the city managed to save hundreds of millions of liters, and I'm sure that did contribute to sort of easing the pressure on the system as the summer drew to an end and relief eventually came. But so communication, I think, crucial. And I think political pressure, it's not a bad thing. Just keep the pressure on the officials, the institutions. And that was certainly true here, I think, is letters to the paper and social media and so on. People weren't simply saying, "Oh well, we absolutely agree with whatever the city is saying." They were very, very, very hostile often and so on. And that's really part of the environment in which city officials should really be functioning in. So they've got to be under pressure all the time to deliver. Sometimes it's not fair, and I think that does eventually emerge. And people who are doing their jobs properly do get the credit for it. But it is a useful thing to do, is to keep up that public pressure that the public service is there to deliver these things and to find solutions. Yeah.
And I think it's also up to voters, You've got to vote out the people who aren't running things properly. But when it comes to something like this, these huge infrastructure challenges, even if tomorrow a group of Swiss technocrats came and took over Gauteng, it would be, you wouldn't be able to fix the problems overnight. And, you know, there's also issues of resources. Even if you've got the right people in place, if there's not money to fix it, there's also only so much you can do. So it's one of these, I mean, you don't call it an intractable problem, but it's quite a big problem. And I always like to use the kind of analogy of a massive oil tanker that needs to turn around. If you want an oil tanker to start going the other way, you can't just do a handbrake turn you could do in an old Golf and turn around in a couple of seconds. You know, turning around a big oil tanker takes you, I've never driven an oil tanker, but I would imagine it takes at least a couple of hours to put the thing going in the other direction. And I think in a complex place like Gauteng, it's not something that you can just do overnight. So I mean, that's I think Gauteng, and the thing is, Gauteng is obviously an important province. It's still by far the biggest contributor to the economy. Its latest figures just came out yesterday. It still contributes a third of South Africa's total GDP. Still more than, I mean, that's more than double KwaZulu-Natal or Western Cape. So it's still important, still the most populated province. And it's, I mean, it's a place that needs to work if we want South Africa to work. We can't just, rely on the Western Cape and Cape Town to keep South Africa going. So and also I'm obviously from Gauteng, so I'd like to work. But anyway, moving on. And then on to our final topic, which is something that Anlu really wanted to talk about. She was insisting on it. It's about the drop in interest rates yesterday that we had. So there was a cut of 0.25%, or 25 basis points, or 0.25%. And I think the interest rate is now 8%. And it's the first time we've had a drop since, I think, was May last year. So, Anlu, is this good for, I mean, what does this mean? Obviously, it's good for consumers. But do you think the SARB could have cut it by a bit more? Do you think they're a bit cautious? And how much do you think this is just South African issues? Or do you think, I mean, are we just basically following the Fed? Because the Fed also cut on Wednesday and they cut by 50 basis points. So do you think, I mean, was it inevitable after the Fed cut? Or, I mean, how much leeway does South Africa, does the Reserve Bank have in itself? Or do we just basically just follow what the Fed does?
Well, I definitely think it was a reaction to what to the Fed's cut. But what I saw, when was it this morning? I read somewhere, I can't remember whether it was a press statement or what it was. But anyway, it was a statement by the DA that said that the interest rate cut, obviously they welcome it. And the message was basically that it's a reaction of a good GNU agenda of which they played a major role. And I just thought that's so funny, because I think it's supposed to at least be very independent. It was just funny for me, to me, that they actually saw the gap there and they tried to take it. I think it definitely provides a much needed relief. I think it was in March. I can't remember which outlet published it, but it's something like 20 million debt active people in South Africa, and most of them is like working age, and it was a figure, it was something insane, like 80% of people that they take home pay, that they pay to like servicing debt. So I think definitely this will provide some relief to much of our debt active population, and give a little bit of breathing room at least, and then obviously with inflation that also went down somewhat, and the rand strengthening, it was this morning I think at something like 17 point, was it 50 cents, 17.51,
it was under 17.50 yesterday,
it definitely it's a sign that we're at least moving into more stable conditions, and it's definitely encouraging. I think there's also, I read something about a potential another fuel decrease. So definitely a bit of relief to all consumers.
I think the petrol price is going to come down by more than a rand a litre next month. So that's quite significant. So Michael, do you feel like there's kind of, are we starting to turn the corner, or do you think this, we all need to hold on to our horses and things are, you know, before we start dancing the streets and cancelling our planned emigration to Australia, or, you know, before we you know, not turning all our money into gold and burying it under, in the back garden or whatever. Do you think, I mean, do you feel that, I mean, there has been a bit of a positive air in South Africa, I think, since the formation of the GNU. Of course, I mean, there have been a couple of speed bumps, things like Bela and so on. And there's still, I mean, there's a lot that can still go wrong. And I mean, just as we were saying now, I mean, there's still a lot of problems in South Africa. Obviously, things haven't been magically fixed and they're going to be very difficult to fix still. But do you think, I mean, this... things do feel a bit more positive, I think. I mean, you also get that kind of feeling, and what do you think?
Yeah, I think on the whole, I was reminded of a chat we were having on our one of our staff WhatsApp groups, where one of the thoughts was that, you know, perhaps sentiment at the moment is the substance of the GNU, but, you know, we don't have forever to follow that up with giving it substance. The sentiment needs to be underwritten by the real stuff, and I think that's obviously going to be measured in the months to come with things like better NHI and so on, expropriation legislation. We want to see, you know, substantive shifts on these quite stubborn kind of policy positions that the ANC had when it was solely in government. It's now relying on partners, and it needs to start showing that it's willing to listen to, you know, kind of saying the messages from, especially from the DA, it's sort of its main partner. Just looking at a piece by Ed Stoddard a few days ago about consumer confidence index rising 5 points in Q3 to minus five. That doesn't mean anything to me. It would mean a lot to you, I'm sure, Anlu. But my knowledge of economics is feeble, so I'm just taking it on the surface of things. It rose to 5 points, the highest level since the first half of 2019. So that has to be, you know, quite a significant thing. But there is this line which, you know, I couldn't help spotting, if I can now just find it, that the confidence is not as high for, and I'm just trying to see where it is. I can't see the detail, but the confidence, basically the essence of it is the confidence. This confidence is not as high for low-income households. And so there's a different experience for people who maybe don't have debt. Obviously, the debt would, you know, that's a major thing for middle-class families like ourselves, with, you know, huge expenses in education and security and healthcare and so on. Any sort of reduction in and bonds, any reduction in interest rates is going to be, you know, a relief. But until the economy is actually really turning around on the ground, if you like, you know, it's cost of things, availability of jobs, people beginning to earn a salary, earn more. And I'm often reminded of your point, Maurice, that you always make. I think it's the most important point to make is that behind the figures are real people who are desperate, who are, you know, devastatingly anxious about the future, their own future, the future of their families. So, that, you know, until that begins to change, we aren't going to see that, you know, solid economic base beginning to firm up and provide the kind of launch pad for a you know, more prosperous future. So good things, I think, good signs, and we now just need some kind of follow through to confirm them and to keep that movement moving, keep that movement going.
Okay, then in our last minute, I'll ask you again to keep your economist hat on. If somebody came to you and they say they've got 5 million rand saved up and they want to know what to do with it, would you tell them put it all into South African equities, or you say, are you crazy, stick it into the US, or would you say put some in South Africa, or what would you tell them?
Being wise, I'd say you'd have to ask a financial investor. Do not take advice.
Say the person that's very little airtime left and they could only get hold of you.
Well, I would speak from a patriotic sense and say that South African stocks are generally undervalued and that I think they should invest back in South Africa. That would be my advice. Of course, right after I told them to at least see an official financial investment person who can give them good advice. But yeah, that would be my advice.
Okay, thanks, Anu. I don't know if if I was advising the person, I don't know if I'd tell them to put all their money in South Africa, maybe a bit. But anyway, I'm not even an economist, so I'll keep quiet. But thanks for watching, everybody. That's all the time we have for today. Enjoy the cricket that's on this afternoon and the rugby tomorrow. Springbok should win the rugby championship tomorrow. And and mazel tov to our colleague Nick Lorimer and his future wife. And thanks for watching, everybody. See you guys on Monday.